Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field, author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution. Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing the creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
The economy isn't physics. It's not governed by scientific laws outside our control. It's made up of people making choices about our values and what kind of society we want to live in. Despite what we're constantly told on TV, most Americans share a lot of the same values. They want an economy that's fair and just, where hard work pays off for everyone, no matter who you are or what kind of work you do, where everyone has the economic security to raise a family and to retire with dignity. When you look at our economy, it doesn't reflect the society most of us want. You can't look at decades of growing worker productivity with workers getting a smaller and smaller share of the profits they create and then think the economy looks fair. You can't look at the racial wealth and income gap that has barely budged since we passed the Civil Rights Act and think the economy looks just or that we have equal opportunity. You can't look at the millions of Americans whose hard work doesn't even pay the bills while corporate profits go up, CEO pay soars, stock buybacks and dividends explode upward and think that this economy reflects our values. The state of affairs didn't happen on its own. It wasn't just the invisible hand of the market.
Those comments were made by the chair of the Senate Banking Committee, Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio. We thought they did a good job of portraying the stark realities of the American economy, which has submerged vast majorities into penury while propelling a small contingent into stratospheric monetary wealth. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. Our guest today, Alana Hartsock, is an expert on the genealogy of impoverishment at the hands of a fundamentally unfair economic model, one that has separated the masses from the basic human rights that we Americans hold dear, and also from their rights as citizens of the planet Earth. As Senator Brown says, the economy isn't physics that is created out of our control. It's made up of choices, and these choices are now under careful reexamination in the face of ever-evolving monetary and civic deprivations. Interestingly, the historical management and later ownership of land is at the heart of how this system has evolved into a cash cow for financial interests and expulsion for those without money. Let's talk with Ellen. Ellen, what's your view of this history of land ownership and wealth?
Michael Hudson in his book, And Forgive Them Their Debts, takes it all the way back to the first civilization with a written history, which was the Sumerians 5,000 years ago. And he shows that our whole banking and money system evolved as an accounting system, keeping track of who owed what to whom. And it was basically a management system for a feudal society. So you had the temple at the center, the king owned everything, and owned the land, and the serfs worked the land and were supposed to pay a tithe. And so this accounting system kept track of everything they spent. And then at the end of the growing cycle, they would, it would all get settled up. But if they couldn't pay, then, like there was a bad crop year or something, then they could pay interest and carry it over into the next year. But then the interest built up pretty quickly. And so it was all equalized with debt jubilees, periodic forgiveness of all the debts, and then they'd start over. But we can't do that today because the king does not own everything. I mean, we've got private lenders and they are not open to forgiving debts periodically. So we're kind of stuck in a system. And then Alana traces it to, we also obviously had feudalism during the Middle Ages where the king or the Lord owned everything or owned the land, and then the serfs worked it. But they had a commons area that everybody, that belonged to everyone, and you could work that yourself and grow your own food or whatever. And now we know, and then of course we have gone through a period of slavery and freedom, freeing the slaves. But to be free in the sense of nobody's telling you what to do doesn't do you much good if you don't have the commons, if you don't have some land you can work or some way that you can support yourself. We've gone from mom and pop capitalism to industrial capitalism, which is also something Michael Hudson, you know, he talks about industrial capitalism versus financialized capitalism. So that right now we have financial capitalism where you owe to the banks, and it's the banks that are parasitizing and sucking the money out. And that's where we are today. And we need to get the commons back somehow. And so that's what Ilana is talking about, is a way to equalize, level the playing field when we no longer have like a wilderness where everybody can go out and stake out their own interests, where we have to find some other form of commons, some other way to share, so that everybody starts at a more or less, I mean, obviously we're not going to get rid of the wealthy in a blow like that, but at least everybody should have the basic Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, the bottom rung of shelter, food, and education.
I thought it was interesting in her description of how this happened is that, you know, early on, before there were economies of real formulaic civilized economies, the people had an inherent wealth in the land itself, which they, of course, grew and fed on, fed off of, and so forth. And it wasn't until when the people got separated from the land and money replaced it, then they became debt slaves instead of chattel slaves in some instances. Her talk about land value tax, I think, is a revolutionary idea, but it's not really that new, is it?
No, it's well over 100 years old with Henry George, late 19th century.
Yeah, and so, and her idea, which we'll let her describe, talk about, is that that the value of the land belongs to, is a more appropriate taxation base, and that people should not be taxed for their work, for their income, the things that they create. Rather, it's the value of the land itself that should create our baseline of economic strength and value.
Yeah, and the other commons as well, the things that should belong to everyone.
Yeah, the notion of commons and our commonwealth is certainly something that is, we're having to struggle to remember that the highways and the parks and the museums and all that stuff belongs to us, are including all of our utilities and infrastructure and so forth. But the financial interests, or post office, perfect example, that belongs to us. The private interests want to come in and financialize that for their own private interests, taking it away from us. And so postal banking, for example, they're seeing that as the financial interests see that as a threat, even though it would be a very useful resource for us all to have at this time.
Yeah, I was just I thought about writing about this, but in Japan, Japan Post Bank was the largest depository bank in the world at one time. I mean, now it's been partially privatized. But the way it was set up was, so all the people put their money in Japan Post Bank because it was secure and it was just a place to save it. And then the bank itself used all that liquidity to buy bonds, the federal bonds. So the post office was funding the federal government. So the bonds, and this was for infrastructure. So it seems, and that, you know, the inspector general in 2013 had a white paper on postal banking and that how they could make money on postal banking. And he was suggesting that you could use the profits to fund or use that liquidity to buy bonds to fund infrastructure. So you could combine something like the National Infrastructure Bill, HR 6422, with the Postal Banking Act, and, you know, use the deposits as liquidity to fund the infrastructure that would be, I mean, because both those bills are lacking something. The infrastructure bill needs a source of liquidity, and the postal banking needs a source of income in order to pay a bit of interest on the deposits.
And in all instances, we need to find ways for us, for the people, to be issuing the credit and the support for these services, as opposed to handing them over to others, so that the Postal Service or the health and education, all of these basic things that Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, laid out, the basic human rights should be built around the Maslow's list of rights, but also other economic fundamentals, which I think would Alana will itemize, but that you're referring to as well. So we live in a very interesting time where, you know, we're questioning some basic assumptions about how the economy should work, who it should work for, and the works of what it's supposed to be doing for our interests.
I'll just throw in one controversial thing. The World Economic Forum and the Great Reset, there's an article on the World Economic Forum website called "You Will Own Nothing and You Will Be Happy." And this was a projection for how things are going to be in a few years. We'll own nothing. In other words, we're back to feudalism. And so that's a threat that a lot of people are concerned about. It's relevant to the whole ownership issue.
Yeah. Ownership is sort of a big issue, not so much about stuff, but really who's in control of the assets of the economy. Is it the people, or is it something that belongs to private parties? So I think we better get on and talk with Alana. You have a nice full-length conversation with her, and she's fascinating. So let's go do that, Ellen. Thank you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be talking to Alana Hartsock, founder and co-director of the Earth Rights Institute, author of The Earth Belongs to Everyone, administrator for the International Union for Land Value Taxation, a two-time candidate for Congress in Pennsylvania, and a longtime Georgist activist. So, Alana, it's great to talk to you again. We did interview you a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. So we have a serious inequality problem here. Even we eliminated slavery theoretically years ago, but we still have a serious inequality problem, which I would say, or you would say, is largely a land problem. And we don't have access to land anymore. When we were colonial settlers, we could go in and stake out our plot of land. I know my great, great, great something grandfather staked out, he homesteaded a farm in Pennsylvania, which, you know, was in my mother's family all the way up till about 50 years ago. So that's what you could do at one time, but now you can't stake out your plot of land. So we need some way to equalize, you know, land. And that's what the Georgist, Henry George School is all about. So you did explain that before, but it was years ago. So I'd love to have you explain again how that works. But also you had mentioned there was a very interesting quote in Harper's magazine that you wanted to read.
There's a couple things, and it's just out, just came yesterday, this April issue of Harper's. And first, Dennis Kucinich, former congressman, has a letter, and I'd like to read a little bit from him, and then I'd like to get a little bit into what they're saying with this Harper's story. And the cover, you see that there? It's saying the next Civil War. And it has a banner that shows the right to revolution. It's red on one side and blue on the other. And it says, "Are we living through another antebellum era? And polarization, tribalism, dysfunction." So I want to read a little bit from that, because we do need a great shift, a great change. And you and I are focusing on the money and the land issues, and we're having this conversation to see how they go together and interact, and how it can be of great value. and building a new economics that's beyond the old right and the old left, to show how poor is the land and banking issues, both the land and money issue, and also the nexus of taxation policy, how important and crucial that is regarding wealth inequality, and even drilling down to this problem of war, for the perennial wars. So first a little bit from what's called A Modest Proposal. And Denis Kucinich is someone who really understands in depth, I think, the money problem. And I had the fortune to sit with him in his congressional office a number of years ago. And we also talked about the land problem. And the reason for that is he was the boy mayor of Cleveland. Remember that? He was the youngest mayor of the country at the time. And he was fighting the corporations to maintain the public ownership of the utilities of Cleveland. And he greatly admired a previous mayor of 100 years previous, Tom Johnson. And Tom Johnson had put in place that public ownership of utilities. So that's kind of bookends. Denis was fighting to keep them, and Tom Johnson was the one who put them in. And Tom Johnson was a great admirer and worked closely with Henry George in that movement. So much so that in the cemetery in Brooklyn, Tom Johnson made sure there was a place for Henry George nearby him. So they're buried right by each other in New York. So Denis is someone who understands the land problem to some degree, but the money problem he can really articulate. So here goes. He says, our pandemic hobbled economy has been propped up by minimal payments to struggling Americans and maximal funds for Wall Street, amounting to a massive wealth redistribution that will only fuel the politics of alienation and resentment. A recent report from the Congressional Budget Office indicates a broader economic recovery may take 4 years. There's a path around this and involves Congress reasserting its constitutional responsibility to coin money. By aligning monetary and fiscal policy, we can protect our national sovereignty, rebuild our economy, pay off the national debt, reduce or even eliminate federal deficits, and guarantee that the dollar remains a stable currency. While his work to change the overall federal monetary system is important, it's a big task. And what I love about your public banking work and the Public Banking Institute is it's something we can do now. We can put in place now. It doesn't depend on any change on that federal government level. And we can also do public banks on the state and local levels. So I think maybe the monetary theory may be similar. You could clarify that, but I think the approach is what we're talking about. What is practical and what's doable? And even though taxation policy is a really, really, you think it's a big federal issue, it's also a very local issue. So by reforming both it to a fair rights to the land and taking the profiteering motive out of land, speculation and so on, hoarding and accumulation of land. It's something we can do locally in cities, and we can do it now with just enough people power to make it happen. Does that make sense?
So you probably need to explain the land value tax. So land value tax is a tax on the unearned value of land or the value created by society, as opposed to, for example, if you improve your house, you did that yourself. And there's no reason why the increased value of your house should be an increased tax that you have to pay. But land value is things like if they put in a subway near your house, that's going to improve mm-hmm. the value of your land. Mm-hmm. Thing that you did yourself, so that should be taxed, or, you know, is appropriate.
Exactly. That's a socially created value. First, the land is a given. It's a commons. It's provided by nature. Since no one made it, why should anyone profit from it? It's okay to have earned income from your labor. But to have it from something that was made by creator, not by human beings, that is a fundamental flaw. And we can trace that back at least 500 years to the enclosures of England and Ireland and throughout Northern Europe, and then eventually worldwide, or at least through the colonized countries. So before the enclosures, there was a feudal system, but there was a fairly good balance. If you were a so-called peasant, you really only had to work a couple of weeks a year, and that was to pay for the protection services of the baron. And you had designated strips of land that was your land to farm on the feudal estate. So their basic needs were able to be met through their labor on land. It was a pretty fair and balanced system. But after the barons got the upper hand, and we like to look at the Magna Carta as this great liberation document, but it liberated the barons from the control of the king and destabilized the system, where the barons could pretty much begin to do what they want. And they could make more money from running sheep on their land than they could with the people, the commons people on their land. So you had a great push to get the people off these feudal estates. And where were they to go? They were, if they survived, they were thrown out onto the streets. They maybe managed to create some settlements or go into the cities, and they tried to find some kind of work, or they tried to craft something that the wealthier people could buy. Since they didn't have land, all they had was their labor. And you really saw the growth of the cash economy at that point. You couldn't trade and barter from what you'd made from the earth, from your fruits and vegetables or the game that you hunt or the clothing that you would make. You had to then have a cash economy. And then, of course, you had to rent to those who owned the land and the dwellings in those cities. So you had this horrific inequality that led to debtors' prisons, people being thrown into prison because they could not pay the money that they owed to the rich people. From the debtors' prisons, you saw a lot of people go then to the New World, to America as indentured servants, Irish, a lot of Irish people, and many others from England, from the London slums. They could come to America if they worked for 7 years once they got here. And those 7 years was to repay the wealthy person who paid for the trip to come here. In the case of Australia, you had debtors who came over. And it was a penal colony. Australia was formed originally when the Europeans came. They were coming right out of the debtors' prisons because the state did no longer wanted to afford to keep them, even in the prison conditions there. So they brought them to work the lands in Australia. I remember being in Australia for a tour there about 14 years ago. And my colleague, Carl Fitzgerald, I was doing an Earth Rights Democracy tour, but he took me to a spot. He took me to a center, an historical center, where there was still a building and still a plaque that talked about the story of a woman who had stolen bread because her children were starving. And for the theft of the bread, she got put in prison and sent to Australia. There are Native American understandings that the problem of the Western world began very much with the enclosures of Europe 500 years ago, because in the same ethic that a few could own the land and push other people off and then charge the people who were remaining, if you didn't kill them or push them west, what they did to the Native Americans and encapsulate them in reservations, the others, that you could charge the rent to live. Well, if you couldn't afford the rent or you wanted to buy, then of course you had to borrow. So then the control of the banking, the banksters, really kicks in when you have no other way to get housing or basic needs met than to borrow. And so the mortgage system just grew and grew and grew. And we can see that fast forward. You could get a decent home in the 50s, 1950s, on one person working in a family, not both mother and father. Situation in my family was my parents did not go to college, but my father was a hardworking small business owner. My mother never worked in the cash economy. She was a homemaker. And they were able to afford a very, very nice upper middle class type of house and could pay it off in a short period of time. And now young people, they can't even imagine how you could do that, because you have college educated people and they can't find jobs and they can't get housing and so on. So the severity of the wealth inequality very much links this original land problem to the point where there's two ways to see that. There's two aspects of the land problem. One is easy to understand. The other is more difficult. The easy to understand is that a few own most of the land in most all the countries that have the kind of economy that we have. Now, in the state of Maine and Florida, 1% of the population owns 2/3 of the private land. Overall, in the United States, about 5% of the population owns about 85% of the private land. We're not aware of that as middle-class people because people are working so hard for a little postage size stamp size bit of land for their house or their apartments. But the fact is that very few actually own most of the private property, private land in the United States. So that is the extensive land problem. Now we have Bill Gates, who has, it's just recently been revealed, been using his billions to buy up agricultural land. Bill Gates is now owns more agricultural land in the United States than anyone else. He's top dog. He wants to have that farmed by artificial intelligence and robots and all the traditional GMO high pesticide agriculture. So this is really bad news for us. But anyhow, it's easy to see the inequity when a few own so much of the land and natural resources, mind you, the coal, the minerals, the oil. But then the problem really exacerbates when the land values keep increasing, and thus the increase in housing costs and the increase to what it takes to run a business, because you need a property to run a business. So all these increases of unearned income accruing to simply who owns the land now, and then the ones who want access have to take the mortgages, ever increasing mortgage amounts to pay the banks. This process whereby wages, earned income, cannot keep up with the cost of housing, i.e. land value. It was well known in classical economics, the whole study, the whole field of the classical economics, and Michael Hudson talks about this very clearly, is the question of the rent, the economic rent. What to do with this free lunch, the unearned income of the land rent. And of course, most of them concluded then, through to Henry George, who kind of rediscovered the whole problem and the solution, they concluded that the land rent based on the land value has to be socialized. It cannot accrue to the landlords and the banks. So our property rights view, the movements that I'm working with, is that what you work for is truly your private property. You have put your labor and your time into creating something. The government should not take any of that away. That is your true private property because you've earned it. It would be like saying, okay, government, I've just planted a garden in my backyard. Why don't you go take half of it? What? It would seem absurd, but that's really what they're doing with the income tax that's on wages. They're taking away gross amounts of working people's income. And the tax on the land rent, what we can call the commons rent, the value that accrues to the commons of the land. To order to have private property, we need to have more people have access to the commons. But to get access now, to get access to land, you have to pay all this mortgage amounts, which really indebts you for 30 years, maybe both mother and father working as working people. So we work to understand that the value of land is created by society, by the schools that tax dollars pay for, by the libraries, by the lighting systems, by the good roads, whatever is provided by public funds increases the land value. And then we should simply capture back that socially created value back to pay for more of the social goods that we need. Now, it's a huge sum. The best estimates are that the land rent is about 1/3 of the economy. It is more than enough to fund our basic needed social needs and activities, even then enable a dividend to go back to individuals, sort of like the Alaska Permanent Fund gives dividends for their oil from their oil rents. So that's the basic rationale for the principles and the policy. And then I think probably you might want me to drill into some of the practical applications of how we're implementing the land value tax or the collection of the commons rent.
So, sorry, did you say that the land value tax would bring in a third of, say that again, how much?
Yeah, you know, GDP, we all know, is a rough and crude and not great measure, but it's about what we have. But when we look at the overall economic picture, and colleagues in Australia have done really good charts on this and others that have looked at it, they keep coming up with this understanding that one third of the economy, of what's called the productive economy or the GDP, appears to be this commons rent that's now privatized. And so what we're seeing is it's absolutely, you can take the tax dollar, taxes, tax burden off of workers' wages and of productive capital, productive, those businesses creating needed goods and services, productive capital, as compared to predatory capital, which is the financialization and the funny money game. So we're talking about productive capital taking the my father would love this as a small businessman. If we want to drive in which public banking institute, we want to drive small business viability and thriving. Let's just not tax small businesses starting with them. We know they're productive. We know they're in their community. So we want to then take those taxes off, and then the commons rent comes out. We could actually provision all of our needed public goods and services with the commons rent, with capturing the unearned income that now goes into create wealth in the private sector. The top 0.1% is really, it's the financial mechanisms ultimately growing from this rent, then through the financial system, the money system, and so on. We might put the patent system in there too, intellectual property rights. I think we have to look at those as enclosures. But this is what is really accruing to the top 0.1%.
So how do they figure the rent? I mean, I'm just thinking of my grandparents' farm. Like they had, I think, whatever you can offer that was, 160 acres, something like that.
Well, you know, an acre of land in a rural area is worth much less than a square yard of land in the middle of New York City. So we have to think a little more abstractly, not just thinking surface land. When we say land value tax, you're going to tax the farmers. No, the tax is going to fall in those urban centers where the big companies, the big corporations, a lot of the bad guys and the banks are located. And the way the property tax is set up now, with an upside down property tax, with more taxes on the value of your building than on the value of your land. The corporations, the big skyscrapers, they use the depreciation of their buildings, and they write the depreciation against what they would owe in their local property tax. And again, they come out paying little or nothing in local property taxes, and yet they take advantage of all the services that the city provides. So land value is like, think of an oil well or a gold mine in the center of our cities. And that oil and that gold is going to whoever has that location. And they are in a very advantageous locational position to run their empires from. So they would begin to have to pay, if you don't tax them on their buildings, they would have to pay their land tax, their land value tax. And then they would begin to pay a fair share of their city's expenses. But then you start applying this and other places where they do own a lot of land and resources. And the agribusiness, big ag, owns much more land than the small farmers in the United States. I mean, that's just saying the same thing. If you're a big agricultural industry, you're going to own a lot more land than a small farmer. So that's where the land value tax falls. It's going to fall on really corporate holdings for the most part, because they are not the most efficient use of those vast lands as a small farmer is, because we're taking taxes off of the buildings, off of whatever you create. A small farmer has a lot of buildings. They have a farmhouse, they have their barns, they have their equipment and things. We're not taxing them. We're not taxing them on their wages. Corporations simply have a lot of land. So they would be paying more and more tax. Now, this is not necessarily confiscatory. It depends on where your land is located and the value of it. For instance, in Pittsburgh, where we've had a pretty strong local land value tax for quite some time. One company that had industrial use of land that was having jobs and everything, providing something useful to the community, and also had land along the riverfront that was being used, really, they were hoarding that land. It was a land speculation scheme. Well, that land along the river that was speculation holdings, they were going to pay more on that. But where they were well utilizing their land, providing goods and services, they were not going to have any problem at all paying their land value tax. So what's helpful in this understanding is we're not like big is bad, small is always good. We're not like your big corporation, you're automatically bad. When the way that people talk on the political left is they're against corporations, but they're not making any distinction between corporations that are some size of big business providing some goods and services versus a corporation that's holding massive amounts of real estate that has the control of the oil, the control of the other minerals. So the reason they're not able to make this distinction and they're just saying big is bad, which then makes you sound like you're anti-business. And so the right thinks, oh, the left is anti-business. They're communists or something, ultimately. They don't want the market. So the right has the grounds to be concerned about the left. Where this is out of the box is we say we know how to have an economy that's both fair and free, a fair free market. We know how to have a system that is both equitable and efficient. These are things that drive right to left the battle. We say it's both and. If you address properly the land problem, the structure of the tax, and the money problem, we can move out of that box and really build a movement for economic democracy that has historical precedent. We have looked at how the macroeconomics is structured actually through thousands of years. Back to the Vedic period, the Indus River Valley, that was 5,000 years ago. The research is there. And looking at China and the Middle East, and what we've seen is that when societies do not allow a usurious, do not allow the unfair money system to accrue wealth for the few, and have a way to have fair access to the Earth's land and resources as a birthright, that is when we start seeing golden civilizations. When a few start getting control and pushing others off the land and you have this domination mindset come in, then you start seeing the conflict, the wars, the poverty, the wealth inequality, and the debtors' prisons, and the total breakdown. Now, we are really in that breakdown or breakthrough point in the United States. We are breaking through, and we have to break through nonviolently to a new understanding of how to fairly structure an economy.
So would Bill Gates be our largest taxpayer if we impose this?
He would certainly be a big one. He would certainly, I mean, right now, the super wealthy have all the ways they can break the laws. I mean, they have all the lawyers to do tax shelters and so on. And so, as we know, big corporations are often paying no taxes at all. It's difficult if they're hiding money in offshore islands to get at them to tax them. Whereas if you have a commons rent system on surface land and natural resources, you can well see what tangible wealth they own where so that you can tax them. And by taking money, after all, money is a symbol system. People have lived without that simple system, simple indigenous access to land and resources, to your food and your water and your shelter. The necessity for that cash develops as you have an advanced complex society like we do. So through kind of going back and seeing it through the land lens, we can say, well, they can do what they want with their money, but we're going to create a new system. We're going to tax them on the land that they hold in our major cities and throughout. And then that tax dollars now with public banking should go into a public bank so that there is no usury happening through the banking system. And the public bank can then give fair interest, low interest loans to people that need the loan borrow money for their basic needs to build a house or whatever. So then you've gone from a vicious circle, which we have now, and then you go to a virtuous economy, strengthening local governance, actually, in the right direction, and being able to provision basic needs once again, that the people can provision through their own labor. And by capturing this unearned income, we can, even though whereas people, we customarily have access, direct access to land, we're substituting that with a payment from the land rent as a citizen dividend. There's a lot of talk about citizen dividends. Who's going to pay that? How's it going to be created? But in place of direct land access, that citizen dividend check out of the land value, which there's more than enough to give everyone, is an income that can be seen as everybody's equal right. On the basis of everybody's equal right to earth as a birthright. It's a birthright. We can't exist without the earth. It's a birthright that's been taken from us through all sorts of corruptions and connivings and lower consciousness mindsets. But those people have become very powerful. But we're trying to now have a fair society. So the citizen dividend coming from the land rent makes a lot of sense. And we had a German economist some decades ago called Silvio Gisell. And he understood that very clearly, both the land and money problem. And he was advocating for a check to go to. He said at the time, he said, it should go to mothers, first of all, so that mothers have some independent source of income, so that they will marry not for wealth, but for the integrity of the male, of their partner, because they will not have to be dependent on a male. They will have this given income from the land rent during the time when their mothers to help support their children. And he was very clear about that decades ago. He also was using his monetary policies for cities of Germany during the Depression, and it was working very well to rejuvenate those cities, but the state of the German, the federal government completely banished that effective policy. And I think you know why. It's again, control of centralized banking systems that don't want to see any progression in power of the people in addressing the land and money problem.
You had mentioned about the Monopoly game, that it was originally a Quaker, devised by a Quaker woman, and that originally it had a land tax to it. I mean, we all think of, we're in a Monopoly game right now. Everybody's just aware of this, the rich get richer, and what do you do about it? There's no way to equalize the game. So how did that go originally? What was the land?
She was a Quaker and very big social justice person. And she invented this game. It was a folk game. It would be passed around and others would, it was called the Landlord's Game originally. And she showed how the wealth accumulates under a current system, accumulates in the hands of the few, landlords and bankers. And then how through using a land rent policy, you would keep constantly redistributing the wealth to the people. So you played it first on the rules of the way society set up and neoliberal economics. And then you played it on the lines of the Henry George economics, which is also the perennial wisdom teachings, because like I said, we've traced the policy back thousands of years. Michael Hudson's traced it back quite some time. So you see, there is a perennial wisdom teaching around truth in economics. So she was able to show that in the game, how to liberate yourself from the monopoly. So that's all we're talking about now, how to actually play the second part of Lizzie McGee's game. Unfortunately, Clarence Darrow got a hold of the game and he found out how he could patent it in his name. And Harper Brothers, whoever owns the Monopoly game patent, was able to make a lot of money from the Monopoly game. And they took out the second way you played the game. So it is an interesting history. There's a whole book about it.
Yeah, I'd like to see the game.
I'll try to get you the game and the history.
Yeah, we tried to devise a Monopoly game about public banking, but we couldn't really pull it off. But anyway, interesting.
Well, let's work on this one and we'll bring out the land and money connections really well.
Maybe we should bring out the original. And you mentioned about the Vedas. I know that Michael Hudson's written about the Sumerian cuneiform writings and that was the origins of our banking system, goes back 5,000 years. And it was basically a feudal system where you had the temple and it was the temple that managed the, you know, it was the center of the feudal system, and that mm-hmm. and the serfs had to pay a certain tithe every growing, you know, after every harvest season. And if they had a bad season, they could pay interest, but the interest built up. I mean, it was a quite high interest of 30%. And the way they equalized everything was with periodic debt jubilees, which is mm-hmm. what he writes about. Mm-hmm. So what did they do in the Vedic system? Did they have a...
Well, first of all, those debt jubilees, what they realized that for a new king to come in, they couldn't come in and have a stable society when you had this gross wealth inequality because of the debt. So then they would cancel the debt. And it's so interesting because he traced it that back before the time of Moses and the Promised Land and Leviticus, because Leviticus 25 has all the, really a lot of what we need to look at today. It's the debt cancellation. Every 7 years, all debts were to be canceled. They're trying to figure out how to make the Promised Land work, right, for the people. Of course, first they kicked out the other people, but we won't go there right now. So every 7 years, the Silver Jubilee, all debts are canceled. Every 7 times 7 plus 1, every 50 years is the Golden Jubilee. So you had both the debt cancellation and you had the right of return. So when the Promised Land was first established, each tribe had a land allocation. Some of the, we're talking about the tribes of the Moses brought into the desert and through the desert, right? The tribes of Judea. So if there was better, more fertile land, your tribe got less land, and the tribal group that got that had poor land got more land. So they try to make it equitable in terms of fertility of land. But then they said, now this is not in the Bible, it is in the Talmud. It's in all those books that the Jewish people keep that aren't in the Judeo-Christian Bible as we know it. But there's a conversation, this is very interesting, between the rabbis, and they're saying, well, okay, we figured that out, but what about those who are closer to the market, being Jerusalem? If your land is closer to market, you don't have to travel so far. It's less expensive to go to market. But if your land is much further from the market, it's unfair because you have to travel so far. How do we make that fair? And they're looking at the issue of labor in relation to land differences. In this case, land equality to the market differences. And they said, well, we know we'll have those who are further, closer to the market of Jerusalem, they will make cash payments to those with a disadvantaged locations further away from the market. Well, that's what we're talking about land value tax. We're saying make a fair payment. If you have more or better valued, higher valued land than other people, you have an unfair advantage. So you're to pay into the common fund a land rent that will equalize that. And we're not going to take, it's not about taking land away like an accrued kind of land reform. It's like a current property taxes. I can keep my property if I pay my property taxes that pay for social goods. It's so easy to do, actually. It's just removing the tax from your houses and your buildings and your production and shifting it onto land value. All the assessors, they can get up to speed on how you do the most accurate land value assessments. All the mechanisms are in place to have economic democracy. That's the brilliance of this. We don't have to really have any kind of, certainly we don't have to have a violent revolution to make a big shift. We can have a totally nonviolent big shift in our land and money policy by just enough of us understanding how to do it. In the city of Allentown, our third largest city in Pennsylvania, the people voted in to freeze all the other forms of local taxes and only have a land value tax that could be increased. That I could say more, but it's a very interesting story of how they voted this policy into place through a simple but fundamental shift in property tax. So back to your question, which now I remember your question, you wanted to know about the Vedic period. Well, Nicholas Kazanis is a Greek scholar of the Vedic period. And he came out, he's looked a lot at the Vedic and the Indus River Valley civilizations. And he did the, he found out, he has a book on Vedic economics, and he says, we were surprised to find that, we thought land value tax was a fairly recent policy approach. We were surprised to find 5,000 years ago in this river valley, a land value tax. And that society had infrastructure. It had actually co-equal leadership, male and female. It had a lot of the progressive things that we look to today. That civilization had it. It had beautiful buildings. It had water and sewage pipes. And, you know, if you go further back in the Vedic period, as I've been really getting into lately, there's the evidence for the Varanas. Varanas were, they had airplanes back then. And believe it or not, the Indian government is now studying those, what they have evidence for those ancient airplanes in order to further develop their aeronautic systems. Isn't that interesting? So the Vedic civilization was worldwide. It was a higher consciousness time on planet Earth. It was, people were more understanding and in tune with the connectedness of all life, that we're one human family, that we're all connected to nature, we're part of nature. So this unity or oneness consciousness has a parallel economics around land rights, tax policy, and money. But then when it starts collapsing for whatever reason, the river changed its flow, there was some cataclysmic climatic thing that happened, there's various theories, but when there is then, or just for some reason, consciousness starts becoming separative, more ego-identified, rather than the unity consciousness. When that starts happening, you see the polarization on many levels, and then you start seeing the mind, the greedy mind come in, where the few use their power, their personal power, or group together to then dominate the rest. And you can see that that story in bold throughout centuries, throughout thousands of time, thousands of years of time. And this is what happened to Christianity. You had this poor carpenter who became a very conscious soul who got the unity consciousness, we're all one, and started teaching that in great following. And they challenged Rome, and then they were killing the Christians, and then the more Christians were forming, and then Rome, what are you going to do with it? So they founded Christianity as the Roman religion. And their question, this is under Constantine in 325, the Councils of Nicaea and so on. They founded Christianity finally. This is going to be our state religion. And this is what it is. And this is what it means. And if you don't believe it this way, you're a heretic. But the most important thing I think that happened was it took the economics of Judeo-Christianity, which is a perennial economics of fairness and sharing and justice, which had a land ethic of koinonia. The land is God's gift to us all for the autarkeia, the self-subsistent livelihood of all. That's the original land ethic of Judeo-Christianity before it gets corrupted. The Roman land ethic was dominium, legalized land acquired by conquest and plunder. So the thing is, how are you gonna get these pacifist Christians to fight in the Roman wars? Or land conquest wars, where you grab land and then you legalize from your conquest that now the land grabber is the owner. Same thing happened, Native Americans, it's happening now. Well, you have to have a theory that sounds like it's justice. So they developed the just war theory. When is a war just so that you nonviolent pacifist Christians will be willing to fight for the good? So it was a kind of a using the cleverness of the mind to twist the morality of the people into fighting the Roman wars. And we saw that land conquest happened worldwide in colonialism. It hasn't really stopped the land conquest out of that mindset of dominion. So that is what we see. We see people understanding these perennial truths and wanting to build systems that work for everybody, because we realize we're all one human family. And at the very least, if I want my family to be happy, I better make sure other people are doing okay, or there might be trouble even for my family. So even for enlightened self-interest, we want a fair society, I would think. So we went from societies that got that and established systems of land and money based on justice and unity consciousness to when that's forgotten somehow. And we're at a time when it's that badly forgotten. It's been nearly lost, but we're needing to bring it back, which is why we're having this conversation, isn't it, Ellen?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I'm afraid we're at the end of our time here.
It's probably a good place to end.
Yeah, very interesting to me. All right, that's great, Elena.
Okay, thank you for the time.
Any parting words you want to throw in?
Well, I would say that we have a land value tax group working for Baltimore. And if you know anybody, if any listeners have people in Baltimore, please connect with us on that. We're having a webinar on April 10th is scheduled called Economics of War and Peace in the City of Baltimore. And Ellen and I will both be on that and other banking, public banking people. And we're going to make the connections of this big picture of war and peace to war and peace in our own cities, and then specifically war and peace in Baltimore, and how we can address it through changing the land and money systems of Baltimore. So I want to have you be on the know for that April 10th webinar. I want you to know that you can sign up for the International Union for Land Value Taxation newsletter at theiu.org. And we have on our board people from right now 22 different countries. So we are a global movement, small but global, theiu.org. We very much invite you to participate with us. And that's, I guess, it. My book you can get for free as a PDF on theiu.org. resources book section of that website. That's a collection of 30 of my articles and essays, and it did receive the Radical Middle Book Award a few years ago. So that's it.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, Elena. I've been speaking with Elena Hartsock, founder and co-director of the Earth Rights Institute and administrator of the International Union for Land Value Taxation, which you can find at www.theiu.org.
Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.